Well, Wednesday morning on the Two Truths, and thank you for those who are online. We're doing this whole thing on the Two Truths, and the structure is quite simple. We do a short meditation and we take refuge together. Then I'll begin the class, and in the class there are sections for questions and also a section for meditation. The questions come up, I think, at least twice, and the meditation two or three times. So please get comfortable in your seat, and we'll do the meditation first of all. Just drop your shoulders, make sure your back is straight. You can close your eyes or keep them open. And you can place your hands wherever you like. Now let your body breathe itself. And feeling the body breathe itself. Relax into awareness. And from within that state of awareness, imagine that the floor is a blue lapis lazuli flecked with gold. The space above you is full of rainbows and light and falling offerings. And in the space in front of you, on the throne, is a cushion of lotus, sun, and moon seed. And sitting on the seat is Buddha Shakyamuni, the essence of every kind teacher you've ever had. In front of the Buddha is the holder of the Dalai Lama, from whom is Lhasa and any other form. They're surrounded by all the other Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and deities. And beside you on your left is your mother. To your right is your father. In front of you are people who don't like you and you have difficulty relating to. And behind you are your friends and your family. Surrounding them are all sentient beings. And you remember how fortunate you are to still be alive today. And you still have the leisure and opportunity to attain your spiritual goals. It's best that you act quickly, because things are not quite right. And things don't exist as they seem to. And while this is the case, nevertheless, you do have a spiritual friend leading you in the safe direction of the three rest alignments. So make your practice purely for the benefit of all sentient beings. See yourself as clear as a deity holding a mantra and bell. And you're experiencing the great bliss. In front of the refuge girl, join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. And imagine from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down, and these dissolve into yourself and all living beings surrounding you. And all negative comments and obstructions are removed. And your good health, long lifespan, virtues, and Dharma realizations are increased. We're cleansed by wisdom and love, recollect the four immeasurable thoughts, decide to develop these yourself, and to establish all beings in those four boundless and immeasurable states. And join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that's without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. But in response to this, our wish and ask, imagine that from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectars stream down and dissolve into yourself and all living beings. Your negative karmas and obstructions are washed away. Your good health, your long life, your virtues and Dharma realizations are increased. Now relax a little more and prepare to make the prayer in front of the field for accumulating merit. So wishing to purify the mind completely and accumulate the merit necessary to become enlightened, a field for accumulating merit appears. And we say in front of it, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and other spirits to the great enlightenment. To the purified body, speech, and mind, and the accumulated merit, we do not wish to hold on to these as if they truly exist. To prevent that grasping, we imagine that our mind, body, speech, and virtues are all transformed into a universe which we're going to offer to the field for accumulating merit. And so we say, this ground, anointed with perfumes, sown with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field of offering. May all living beings endure this pure land. The Buddha accepts it and he smiles at you with delight. And you look up into his eyes. Looking into the eyes of the Buddha, you find immense humility, kindness, and acceptance. Now, from out of the field for a human merit, comes your root guru. He comes to bite off the crown of your head and puts his hands together to the prayer mantra, and he makes a request to the lineage masters. He requests that these enlightened beings pour down their inspiring blessings upon yourself and all your mothers who surround you, so that everyone may quickly stop all perverse minds, so that you might all quickly generate pure minds, and our outer, inner, and secret obstructions be pacified. And from the heart of each holy being, streams of light and nectar flow down, granting blessings and purifying them. You recollect the meaning of renunciation, bodhicitta, and the correct view. And from the heart of the Buddha, infinite light rays emanate. These reach every environment and all beings. And everything dissolves into light, which dissolves into the Buddha, who then dissolves into your root guru at the crown of your head. Your teacher begins to diminish in size, becoming smaller and smaller, enters your crown and descends to your heart. His mind and your mind become one nature. Within that nature, you hear the mantra of the Buddha. You join in the start of the mantra. I am a Tamuni Muni Mahamudayasa. I am a Tamuni Mahamudayasa. I am a Tamuni Mahamudayasa. Friends, it might fill 10 directions of space. And every sentient being, the body within space, is utterly transformed into a fully awakened state. You have accomplished your own purpose and the purpose of all beings. The light rays withdraw from the 10 directions of space and re-enter your heart. You can hear traffic, you can feel the seat beneath you. You are embodied. Your body is breathing its heart. And from this state of presence, you understand this is a meditation of imagination. It has imprinted the mind with this potential to be fully awakened for the benefit of beings. This potential needs the support of wisdom and compassion. You decide to develop your own wisdom and your compassion for yourself and for all beings. To find an authentic teacher and to engage in this path. And then breathing deeply through your nostrils. Exhale through your open mouth. Let your eyes flutter open. And bring your presence back to where you are and move your body and make yourself feel quite comfortable in your seat. Oh, okay, we're doing this course on the two truths, and I've been relying primarily on these three books here. We began by looking at the two truths themselves. Then we looked at them in terms of emptiness and dependent origination, the stages for developing the realizations of ultimate truth, supported by conventional truth. And then lastly, we looked at the schools of lower tenets for Great Exposition or Sutra. The other names they used to report by Bhashyaka and Sartrantika. And that was our focus last week. So what these schools have something in common with one another, but they're quite different too. So what they have in common with one another, first of all, is the way they see the person. So the ultimate nature of the person is to be without a self that is permanent, independent of their body and mind, and singular. There's no such person. That's what the person is empty of, that type of self. Even more deeply, the person is empty of any self-sufficient, substantial nature. If a person were to have a self-sufficient and substantial nature, you could remove the body and mind and there would be the person. This is the ultimate nature of the person. The conventional nature of the person, the conventional truth about a person, is that they exist dependently upon the body and mind. This is what both schools have in common. This is where they begin to differ. In terms of the ultimate truth, the great exposition, so what ultimately exists are indivisible particles and moments. These things are real. This is the ultimate truth. Anything that can be broken down is a conventional truth. So if we look at ourselves, can we be broken down? You'd have to say yes. We could lose an arm, we could go right down. So we conventionally exist as conventional truth objects. What can't be broken down about us is these indivisible moments of consciousness, partless moments of consciousness, and the atoms that we come right down to, or the smallest indivisible physical particle. That cannot be broken down. That's the ultimate truth about us, about these aggregates. That's how the Vaibhashika present ultimate and conventional truth. The South Africans have a different perspective. They have the same view about persons being empty of a self-sufficient, substantiated, sick person. They're not permanent, independent, or singular. That stays the same with the other people. Where they differ is that they say that whatever performs a function is an ultimate truth. So do people perform functions? They certainly do. So people are ultimate truths. It's quite different from the other one. And what does not perform a function is a conventional truth. Now today we're going to look at two other systems. These ones here are sometimes called the Hinayana 10 systems. They just deal with the selflessness of the person. Mahayana 10 systems deal with the selflessness of the person and in every other type of phenomenon that's not a person. Mainly based on the aggregates, mountains, rooms, desks, whatever. They deal with that. They deal with the real big picture. And there are two systems there, one called Chittamatra or mind only, and the other called Madhyamaka or middle way. What these systems have in common is a wish to become enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings. They want to become Buddhas, omniscient beings. The other two schools, their goal is just singular liberation for themselves. So the Mahayana combines compassion and wisdom and emptiness to achieve Buddhahood for everyone. And these two have ultimate truths and conventional truths also. And they are also quite different. So we'll talk about them as we go through each other. So I'm going to begin by talking about what they call a Chittamatra or mind-only tenet system. And I'll begin with a quote which says that these three realms are mind-only. So you might ask us, what are the three realms? So one of the realms is this one that we find ourselves in. This is called the desire realm. There are two others called the form realm and the formless realm. And these realms are primarily ascertained through deep states of concentration. This quote is taken by the mind-only care system to be literally true. The middle way, say, this needs to be interpreted. Well, what does this mean then if we take this to be literally true? So the mind-only now deny or rule out external objects existing separately from consciousness? Very good. So they say that nothing exists outside or external and not dependent on the mind. This is the major thing. So unlike those two other schools that say there's this indivisible moments of mind and matter out there, the mind only go, no such thing. That's just a mental projection of yours. That's, you made that up. The only thing that actually exists that we can be sure of is the mind itself. So you can see a certain movement, can't you? Before, it's like quite the physical real world made up of these partless particles of physical and mental objects. And these guys are going, no. So, I mean, you must be thinking what that might mean, what we're going to come to that. So this is not what you call a solipsism, where you think everything is just mind, mental. It's not like that, even though it sounds like that. Talk about the fundamentals of each of these systems. So what's fundamental for these guys is that external objects do not exist independently of the mind. What we perceive to be our reality, an external reality, is in fact a mental projection arising from karmic seeds in the foundation consciousness. And our liberation from psychic existence comes about by realizing that all phenomena are mind only. So we dissolve the subject-object duality. So their ultimate truth is that there is no subject-object duality. It's one thing. It does appear to us right now there is a subject-object duality, doesn't it? When you're sitting there and you're looking at me, I'm certainly very different from you. I'm an object or a subject. You look around at the walls, they're very different. They're the objects, I'm the subject. That's the duality. The wall is not me, I'm not the wall. There's two things here. That's what we mean by subject-object duality. There's also a sense that there's a me and my experiences. That's a duality. These guys are saying no such thing, and that's the absolute truth. So our perceived reality is basically like a mental hologram. So what makes the school quite different? So all phenomena are mind only. External phenomena do not exist independently from the mind. So you can see this is quite a different view from what goes previously, and it's quite a different view than how we normally apprehend the world, isn't it? The most important thing about this system is that it's a unique assertion that all phenomena arise from mind-dependent mental imprints. They reject external objects as truly independent realities. Now, what they also do is they, in the previous two systems, when we talk about selflessness or emptiness, that was just applied to the person. And they said, look, the person is empty of a self that could be permanent, independent of their body and mind, and singular entity. The person also would have has no substantial and self-sufficient existence. So these guys agree with that. They go, yep, no problem. We don't refute that at all. We agree. There's no such person that exists like that. That's the selflessness of the person. They're in agreement with the previous statements. But they go further. They look at these other phenomena and they think, okay, what else is selfless? They go, the phenomena. And what are they empty of? A real subject-object duality. That's what's not there. Looks like it's there, but it's not there. And we know it's not there because when we go into meditation looking for that distance, it's not found, it's not there. In fact, everything becomes one entity, mind.
But Eddie, they do still consider those things in the conventional truth.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So we're talking about ultimate truth.
Yeah, the ultimate truth is that they lack the subject-object duality. And the conventional truth is the subject-object duality. And so this phenomenon that's appearing to us, it is appearing because of the ripening of past karmic imprints. That's how they explain it to be. That's why it's all appearing to us. And even why we believe it's separate from us, and that they're two different things. It's because our mind has just habituated itself to that. And so we believe it. Now, like I said before, they say that this idea that the body and anything physical is made up of these indivisible or partless particles. But what they mean by this is you can sort of imagine going down to an atom, but going even further, like we have in Western science, right? We know there's phenomena smaller than atoms. And they go, well, you can go down as far as you like, but in the end, there has to be something there. And they're saying that something has no parts. Because if it had parts, you could divide it again. And they go, you go right down, and if it has, no parts whatsoever, this is what comes up later on, they're going to say, well, then it can't exist. These guys are saying, no, it's just so small, you can't divide it any further. The mind and body. And these phenomena really exist because if they didn't, they wouldn't exist at all. There's got to be something there, right? You think that'd be natural too, like for us, there's got to be something there. Well, there's nothing there. It's something or nothing. These guys have discussed something. Right? That something is the ultimate truth.
That's
Yeah,
the truth.
yeah. What's
So
going
why
on?
don't
Okay, so
we
we look at
consider something?
Swapnu, we can look at it through three different lenses through what we've talked. We can look at it from the Vaibhashika, the Saptarshika, and the mind only. So let's look at each one. But this is the simplest way to do it. If we just leave the intellectual perceive the truth, it's very hard. So we've got to try and take an object. The thing that we take is the person. But if we use like a clock from the Vaibhashika, the very simplest form. This clock can be broken apart, can't it? You can pull parts off. And if you go right down to its smallest parts, you start going down to its atomic nature. And if you just stop there and say, whatever that is, that's the ultimate truth about the clock. All of its parts, that's the conventional truth. Anything you can break down, that's the conventional truth. So the face of it, every part of it is the conventional truth. But the atomic structure is not, that's the ultimate truth. You can do the sort of same about your own aggregates, your mind and your body. Right? Use the clock first and do it with your mind and your body. That's the first system. Second system, Sautrantika goes, comes along and goes, this clock has a function. Therefore, it's an ultimate truth. It ultimately exists, it really exists because it functions. What does not have a function is a conventional truth. So it functions, it's ultimately true. If it does not function, it is conventionally true. That you could say for them. So here it might be like the term forest. So a forest is made up of, it's a name for something. Right? the name itself has no function. They wouldn't go, oh, it's a function for describing a whole lot of trees. You go, no, the trees function. The term forest doesn't. They have other things too also that don't function, like these, the person that has inherited, the person is self-sufficient, substantially existent. That does not function. You ask, why is it this non-existent? The persons that exist like that have no function. Now this then, now you come to mind only, right? So they're going to say, this clock, the idea that the clock is over here, and I'm over here getting at it, that's the object, this is the subject, that gap does not exist. The appearance of the gap exists, that's conventional truth. The fact that I'm looking at a clock, there's a clock there, that's conventional truth. The ultimate truth is that these two phenomena are not different.
Last bit.
Yeah. So I actually can go back even further. So there are a number of different things going on that are not really obvious to us. The first is in the Vaibhashika. They say that when you get at an object, you get at it directly with your mind. So this phenomenon here, well, the clock, our senses are getting directly at that clock. The Sartrantic says, no, they're not. We have a mental impression. That's what we actually get at. We don't actually get at the real things out there. And we know this through neuroscience, don't we? We never actually get at the objects out there, but we do have appearances of them. And we go, that's what I'm talking about, the clock. So their thing now is more about how you're perceiving phenomena. Yet there is still an external world, isn't it, made up of all these atoms and so forth, the real world, just like it looks to us now, those systems. Mind only come along and go, there is no external world made up of all those partless particles and partless moments and so forth. Therefore, this clock can't exist out there like that. Nevertheless, there is a clock appearing to us. Why is that? So because of our mental imprints, they provide this clock, the appearance of a clock. So where is the actual clock then? What is the actual clock? Yeah, mental. So the clock and the conscious accessing are basically one thing, they're not two things. It's a single thing. That's the ultimate truth. The fact that they appear quite separate is a conventional truth. Now, remember, you're not going to get it all today and go like, oh. And I'll just give you a quick overview, snapshots to go, wow, it's quite a different way of presenting phenomena. So like I said, the idea, the view of the self of persons in the mind only, or this Chittamatra system, is no different than what happened before. That's the same. Now these guys are moving over to everything, in particular the aggregates in the mind itself of the person. And these are basically all mind-constructed, made up by mind itself. You might think this is a really strange and just a made-up idea. But it's got a lot of usefulness. And in fact, modern science has come very, very close to this understanding themselves. There's a lot of agreement here. So this is saying, isn't it? This is also saying that our mind can have an influence over physical phenomena. Why? Because the physical phenomena are basically all mental projections. Now this plays out in the world. This is how it is in the world. This is actually true. But this is what modern science has discovered. Mind has an influence on the physical phenomena. it has a massive influence on ourselves, doesn't it? You just start thinking really badly of yourself and see what happens to you. You'll end up getting sick. And all sorts of psychological problems happen, physical problems follow. There's a relationship here between the body and mind, where the mind can affect the body. If it was the other way, the normal other way, that goes physical on the mental. And this is what it was in the pre system. Now, so we come to the self here. So obviously they refute an external self of phenomena. The self of phenomena before was seen to be these partless particles and partless moments. That's the self, something to be found. These guys go at night, nothing like that. What you're going to find is mind. That's the only thing you can be sure of. Now, consciousness truly exists. Now, from our perspective, this is quite problematic, this view, and we're going to throw up lots of arguments about it. Yeah. The most common one, of course, is just sitting here going like this, and you smack your wrist, and you go, that's not mine. That's not mental. I hit my wrist like that when I get hurt. That's more than mental. But that's the most common sort of thing you say. You say, I want to walk across the road around looking at a car, and that's not my mind. But in fact, that's not what the mind owner is saying. That's not actually their presentations. That's just the way we think of what we're hearing them say. Everyone's smart. The other problem that arises, of course, that we each have a mind. So I've got multiple minds. Why do we see the same truth? Why do we have basically similar experiences? And lastly, of course, is the scientific evidence. We could raise that. So hang on, what about modern science? That's very different. So each of these objections that we could bring forth can be met and refuted. These are the modern objections, our objections, but there's lots of objections about this view also coming from Buddhism itself. So I've been trying to read about it all along these last night and this morning and over the weeks before presenting this class. I won't go into many of them, none of them, in fact. I'll just let you think about some of them. So one of the first questions, is mind-only Buddhism denying the existence of a physical world? And the answer is no, they're not doing that. What they do, the physical world is the conventional existence, right? They're not saying that doesn't exist. What they're really looking at is the mental nature of this world. Like I said before, first not see it directly, next goes is this So Vaibhashika was still saying we don't get directly at the evidence, we get a little picture of it in our own mind. And that's what we're always working with, these little pictures, conceptions. But there's another name for them too that I find much more useful. These are the guys going, no, it's all created by the mind. So we've got this sort of all these schools are trying to understand what's called reality, what exists. And so some of them are dealing with the physical stuff. And the others are dealing more with the mental. And there's a gradual movement of free, quick movement towards the mental. And the mind only is sort of going, basically, it's a mental projection. When you think of it as a real physical world and so forth, it's again a mental projection. There is no, the projection is that the physical world is independent of us, not dependent on us. That's projection. But there is an interesting meditation you can do, where if you just sort of sit down and try and work out, you close your eyes and just wait and go, okay, where do I stop and the world begins. Where's my boundary of the person, the self, and the world? Where does subject and object meet? Right, so you can actually say, oh, there's the difference. The real subject, real object. Just sit down and ask yourself that. Just feel it. You're not going to find any barrier there that goes, oh, here I am, this subject, and there's the object. There's no such existence like that. But without the examination, it certainly appears as if there is. So that melting of that barrier, that's the ultimate truth. The fact that there is a barrier that's appearing to us, that's the conventional truth. Well, I thought it was two simple questions, right? Is mind only Buddhism denying the existence of the physical world? Simple answer, no, it's not. Can I prove mind only philosophy is wrong by stubbing my toe? No. Pain is a real experience, but it doesn't prove that your pain exists independently of consciousness. There's a multiple minds objection. This challenges the idea of a shared world. Individual minds create separate realities. Mind only addresses this through the concept of collective karma. Beings with similar karma experience similar mental projections. And they use this idea of the foundation consciousness to explain that. Then scientific evidence objection. This objection argues that scientific understanding contradicts the mind-only view. The response is that science studies the world of appearances and causal relationships between phenomena, but it doesn't determine their ultimate nature. And that's what Buddhism is about, the ultimate nature of phenomena. That's not the role of science. It doesn't do that. And there's a lot of meeting up places here between the mind only and science, in fact, especially these ideas of quantum entanglement and quantum mechanics. When you start looking at that, that's where the mind only really and modern physics come together. But this is the material you can have a look at online. You can just ask questions, go to a place called Perplexity AI. And you put these questions in about the mind only and modern science and anything you like, basically, and you get really good answers. You get even better answers if you put your own texts in and question it. But I've been doing that for the last couple of weeks before presenting this, but it's just so in-depth, so I'm just going, it's very useful, for me at least, but might not be so useful to go right in-depth here in a class like this. I'm just telling you, there are meeting places here between this philosophy and quantum mechanics and modern science. So in terms of the study and practice into the Chittamatra, they try to understand all phenomena as mind only through study, and they have particular texts that they use. Lots of quotes from the Buddha, of course, as he says things like that, and these guys take it literally. So how many here amongst you have heard of what they call the three turnings of the wheel? Okay, so some of you have heard of this. So it's basically a way of categorizing the teachings of the Buddha. And they say the first turning of the wheel, where the Buddha explained the Four Noble Truths, this was primarily for the Vaibhashika and Sautrantika people of that disposition. In the second turning of the wheel, he explains the middle way teachings, how all phenomena are empty. We'll talk about that next. The third turning of the wheel, he explains this teaching, mind only. All those teachings go into the third wheel. And there's argument about which one can we take literally to be true. These guys say this wheel, the third wheel, it's the final teaching of the Buddha, this is the reality. There's a lot of argument about this, the middle way consequence of going, no, it's a second. One of the reasons for that is that these guys make mind more important than the physical world, the phenomena. And the middle way goes, no, mind is not more important. They are of equal importance. They are equally empty. One has no more predominance over the other. What you take away from this is that all appearances are like a dream, and mind is like the painter. This philosophy is really, really useful day to day as we live our lives. And lots of it was used in a phenomenon called mind training in Buddhism, where they take this, the most important thing is your mind is creating your reality. Therefore, you can change it. Change your mind, you change your reality. This is where there's a supreme value of this mind-only presentation. In terms of practical relevance, if everything's been created by mind, what you create is your responsibility. You create your happiness, you create your suffering. It's up to you. So this is one major thing about getting control over your mind, trying to develop a positive mental qualities, because it's going to affect you. That's the first thing that's going to happen. So we are responsible for our own happiness and unhappiness, because it's all coming from mind. If we don't use the mind skillfully, we'll create problems for ourselves. If we're skillful and know this, we create happiness for ourselves. Since phenomena depend on consciousness, any challenge you can be met with what we call mindfulness, meaning we remember the phenomena being created by mind. Therefore, it can be changed by mind. Many of us rely on external things to change the mind, don't we? Most people do. When you become a Buddhist, you take refuge in this and know now I can change my own mind. That's my refuge, the power that I have over my mind. So the mind has a great deal of creative power, as we all know. I mean, every artist is coming out of mind stuff, aren't they? Every musician, it all comes out of the mind. We might not be musicians or scientists, but we all have a mind and we can all change it. And by doing so, of course, then our suffering eases. You'll see most of the time we create our own suffering through how we think and what we believe about our emotions. So as I say, change your mind, change the world. And as the Holy Sovereign says, that peace is not out there. Everyone wants peace. It's like the world has to change and all be peaceful. Peace comes from within. You have to make your own mind peaceful, and then the world's at peace. Thank you. So again, there's a lot of interesting phenomena about this. So I'll just say some of the easiest things that you can take away from this. This is the most important thing, but which is easy, is about these external objects and how the mind is apprehending them. So when we perceive a tree, where is the perception taking place? In the mind, isn't it? So like this is everything there. We're always perceiving our own mental self. That's where the perception is taking place. Our past actions shape our future experiences. This is another simple thing to remember about this philosophy here. What your mind does in the past will have an impact on your future. There isn't anything that exists independently or not dependent upon the mind. Our next philosophy system takes us, runs right with us. Anything you experience is experienced by your mind, not experienced by anywhere else.
So in this system, mind only, don't think or talk about emptiness.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, and the emptiness is of the subject-object duality. That's their emptiness. So that's what they negate. That subject and object exist as separate entities.
So they empty it separately.
Yeah.
But if the concept is in your mind,
yeah,
it's not empty, it's ultimate.
I'm not sure what you mean. Yeah, it's an ultimate truth, right? Because there's no actual separateness between the concept and the mind.
Yeah, yeah.
They're one phenomenon.
So there's no emptiness there.
When that takes place, that is the emptiness of the subject-object duality. Like it's vanished. That's the ultimate truth. And there is something that happens just like this when we realize emptiness, right? The object emptiness does not intrinsically exist, and neither does the mind that's apprehending it. So they are one entity. So they say it's like water being poured into water. Subject, object, duality was banished at that time. So there's a lot of them, as you will see, when you go through these systems, there are some things that are kept and others that are abandoned. Like the thing that's been kept all the way through these systems here is what the Vaibhashikas are what you start out with, which is just the way of organizing phenomena. That's, everything else is basically forgotten in terms of spiritual development. They go, but now it's like primary school. What's really nice here is the fact that we've got a school. We'll keep that. We'll keep going to school. Another way of looking at this is, we study, you might start off with the simplest type of study, which might be biology. So you look at everything from that point of view, very clear to you. But then you step up and you do chemistry, and what you saw in biology all vanishes. You're down to a much deeper level now. You're in chemistry. If you go further than that and you study physics, chemistry all vanishes. You want to go further than that? You go into maths. All that's everything else before sort of vanishes. But you're still working with phenomena, aren't you? You're always working with things. That stays the same. And the idea of going from class to class stays the same. This is what these systems are like. And you might see also sometimes it seems that like I said, so some stuff is abandoned and some stuff is kept. So it can be very useful. Just like, just because you study maths doesn't mean to say biology doesn't exist, does it? It's possible that might not be your primary area of work. Okay, let's do a meditation. I was thinking this one here, this is going to be our longest presentation to mine. I didn't start because it's difficult to get your head around. So let's do a meditation. So here we're going to look at how consciousness creates reality. So let your body settle down and bring awareness to your breath. Let your mind become spacious and clear and ground yourself into the awareness of that clarity. Rest in the clarity. So we're trying to understand how the mind creates reality so that we can create greater compassion and wisdom to bring about freedom from suffering. And as you're breathing and relaxing, notice how your mind is creating experiences right now. Those sounds you hear, the sensation you feel. Every thought that arises. You also can directly transform your experience just by moving your mind to a different object or thinking a different thought. So I wonder how your own day might change if frustrations were to be acknowledged as conscious projections rather than fixed obstacles. Seeing difficulties as projections grants you freedom to respond with flexibility rather than resistance. Might it be possible for you to sense how a recent challenge was shaped by impressions in your consciousness? Our reactions emerge from stored impressions. And this explains why we experience situations differently. But how might seeing others' behaviors as mental projections affect your response to conflicts? To foster compassion, recognizing others' perceptions arise from their unique mental patterns. If you could view challenges as mental events and not fixed realities, this would create greater peace for us. So the mind that realizes its creative role, mind that realizes its creative role, transforms suffering into wisdom and compassion. So just breathe in deeply now, and then exhale. Well, you want to say something about this last line here. The mind that realizes its creative role transforms suffering into wisdom and compassion. So there are a number of stories that have come out of the from the Tibetan tradition of those people being put into jail and tortured and coming out being quite mentally healthy. This is very different than many other people who've gone into jails and been tortured. Most people come out with a lot of trauma. Many of the Tibetans didn't. If you ask not why, it's because of this last line. But what did they do? They also had great compassion for themselves. So what was the compassion that they had towards themselves to not be traumatized by this? Yeah, that was it. They said, this is a natural outcome of my previous poor karma. And thank goodness it's ripening right now like this. But I'm happy to have the suffering erupt now like this because the karma had finished. And I've mentioned a number of times there are great sports people who do a similar type of thing, where they take what we would normally call suffering and don't like, they say, I like it. It makes me strong. If you can say that about your own suffering, you'll be hugely advantageous to you than to say, oh no, please stop. This is terrible. And it's just, like I said, it's just ideas, but it's got a grounding in the philosophy. So the philosophy here is this karma and karmic inputs. And the things that, you know, everything's taking place in the mind. Okay, so now we've got 25 minutes to do the middle way, pretty quick. So the middle way is called Madhyamaka, and there are two schools within it, one called middle way consequence and one called middle way autonomy. They're very, very close, but they're majorly different is how they argue or how they reason. Middle way prasangika or the prasangika, middle way consequence, their arguments made with consequences. They listen to what you have to say, and then they'll argue with you, adopting what you have to say, and show you where you're wrong. Middle-way autonomous have a way of reasoning where you have to go along with the reasoning first. You've got to go, okay, this is how we're going to argue, and then away you go. One of the things that comes about this is the middle way consequence school is saying to the middle way autonomous, to do that, we both have to agree. So they go like, agree on what? So this type of reason, it's autonomous, it's inherently existent, in other words. And the middle way consequence, we don't need to do that. We can use it as useful. But I'll let you run with inherent existence and I'll show you you're wrong through consequences. So this is one of the fundamental differences between the different middle way schools. The major difference between the middle way and every other system is that these guys say there is no inherent existence whatsoever. Not ultimately, not conventionally. They say, middle way, consequence, every other school is grasping at inherent existence, just under different names. And we're saying there isn't anything inherent in this. Their other school is autonomous. They go, ultimate truth does not ultimately exist. In other words, ultimate truth has no inherent existence. As you can see back there, these other schools are saying they inherently exist, they're real. But middle way autonomy goes, no, they're not. Middle way consequence goes, we agree. What about the conventional truths? Ah, no, they inherently exist, they're the middle way autonomous. And the middle way consequence goes, no, they don't. It's where we disagree. So the middle way consequence, they refuse inherent existence across the board, both ultimately and conventionally. Many of the other schools all hold it to exist conventionally. This is the big difference. When it comes to the, we'll come to that. The all phenomena lack inherent existence. This is a big deal here. Because they all lack inherent existence, everything that does exist does so through dependence, dependent labeling in particular. And so they unite ethics and insight. So all appearances are conventional truths, and the ultimate truth is emptiness of inherent existence. This plus and equal middleway consequence, they are different. Like I said, they reject this intrinsic existence entirely. Every other school holds on to some part of it, whether they be inherent particles, whether they be inherent non-produced phenomena, whether it's inherently existent mind, those sort of things. But these guys are different. So when phenomena lack inherent existence, these guys are saying they have to lack inherent existence, because if they didn't, they could not dependently exist. So the funny thing is, they're sort of saying this, look, phenomena appear to be inherently existent. We agree. There's no problem with that. But we say they don't exist here. So the difference here between the way that the phenomena appear and the way they exist, just like in the other schools too, there's differences in appearances. Like I said, some think you get straight out, others think saying you have a mental image, others are going, look, it's all mind. These guys are saying, no, what does it do? It does so dependently. The quote from Nagarjuna, he says, whatever is dependently originated is explained to be emptiness. And that, meaning emptiness, being a dependent designation, is itself the middle way. There does not exist anything that is not dependently originated. Therefore, there does not exist anything that is not empty of inherent existence, inherent nature, inherent qualities. So here we're looking at what's called interdependence, interrelationship. Now, this is the deepest teaching of the Buddha in terms of the conventional truth. It's the easiest way to get emptiness. You just go to dependent. This term is really useful to get your head around. When you look at phenomena being dependent, I'll quickly go through it. Anything that's produced depends upon the causes and conditions to produce it. Anything that exists has parts, depends upon its parts. Whatever does exist depends upon a consciousness to apprehend its existence and a name. There are three levels of dependent existence. Because phenomena exist dependently like that, they have no independent existence. The independent existence, being not dependent, is another name for inherent existence, existing intrinsically within itself, without dependence. If you get your head around this, the last one, that's a real goodie. Depend upon awareness and name. And you hold that with a mind-only idea, that's a lot of power in that. Like if you can try this out on yourself, but right? You look at some phenomena and don't give it a name, just look. So now you're getting aware with your eyes. Now start calling it things. Give it different names and see what happens to you. Like, I can do this with a pair of shoes. They look great. I just gave them the name great, right? Then I try to put them on and they really hurt. And I start calling them different names. The whole perception of the shoe changes. You can do this. You do this with people. You do this with yourself. Look what happens. Depending upon the language you use talking to yourself, you can hurt yourself a great deal or you can make yourself feel great. And it's the same thing with anything external to you. You are apprehending it through your awareness straight off. It's going to, that happens, you're making contact, feeling will arise, and the language is going to come up. Soon as that's the process, right? If you can become aware of the process, you can change it anywhere within it, because it's all dependent. You get different effects each time. It's really wonderful to know this. There's a lot of power in how you apprehend everything, your whole life.
Backtracking a little bit, Anthea asks, you gave a quote, the mind that recognizes its creative role, and she's lost the rest of that sentence.
I don't know, Anthea. I don't know. Might have written it down, but you see. I don't know, Anthea, but you were in that role. I know that. You're a producer.
Something about wisdom, she
wrote. Ah, yes, that's right. Yes, you want to bring compassion and wisdom into your expression of that role. That was very useful for yourself and for others. So it's the same here, you know. So you want to, with your awareness, try to look at the world and through the lens of being empty, which is like open, completely open for you. And what do you want to do? Because we act, we cannot not act. We do. That's the function of human beings. We act. If you act with harshness, that's what you get. That's karma. That's how it works. You create it, you experience it. If you are wise, as you understand, well, all these phenomena are produced, therefore they're impermanent, therefore they're subject to change. There's nothing to hold to here. I can let it come, I can let it go. I'm not a real me either. I'm just a name put on this body and mind. I don't truly exist either, just like anything else. But we're here. And it's not that we're non-existent, we're here. What do you want to do? How do you want to play? Yeah, so the word empty, what you can always is just come back meaning dependent, because the meaning, that's the meaning of it. It means empty of independence, therefore dependent. So this self of the prasamika, the self of persons, for instance, is in every other system, it goes, the self is the I imputed to the four or five aggregates. And for each of those 10 systems, it means something different. So I'll give you an illustration of a person. Someone say, I can't actually, it's indescribable. One school says that, and the Vaibhashika says it's indescribable. But if you push them, they'll go, no, there's no school within Buddhism that says the body is the self. None. So what's left? It has to be the mind. So every school will be saying it's some aspect of mind. So some say it's the mental continuum. Some say it's consciousness. Others would say it's the mind basis of all in the mind-only presentation. That's what they say. And others will go, it's conscious, it's mind. These guys don't say that. They say the person is the I that is merely imputed to the aggregates. So this word merely really has great impact. But meaning it can't be found when you search for it. It's not the aggregates, it's not something separate from them. It's just the name given to them. That's why it can't be found. It's conceptual. It's an idea given a name. That's all it is. That's all we are. In fact, that's all anything is. It's all the same. If you think about that, you'll go, yeah, that's not significant. You go, yeah, it is. It's true. It's all it is. And if you think it's more, that's what we call grasping. And now all the problems begin. It always looks more. It always looks more. And often we're deceived by the look, deceived by the appearance. So merely is a big deal. So the self is a conventionally designated label. That's not the name. Without any inherent existence, without any independent existence, meaning it only exists depend upon a body and mind, depend upon the four or five aggregates. It's not something separate and just on its own. And it's a bit just like saying, if I just make up something, it exists. Yeah, I know it needs a basis for it. You've got to have something to call again. You know, it's the same with us. We have a body and a mind, we call me, I. So it's empty of any essence, but it's full of dependent arising. And when they're full of dependent arising, so they use the word suchness. But to get suchness, that's not the empty on the other side. They're going to get the same thing. And the other term they use is signless, meaning no signs of inherent existence. So the self is like a character in a movie. So I tried to put up, you know, I was using the AI, I said, I want a picture of Hopalong Cassidy roping a cow, you know. Just like Hopalong Cassidy, just a made-up name, isn't it? They put him on the character, he really goes on to see Hopalong Cassidy in the movies. There's no person there, so there's parts of light. In fact, there's no actual Hopalong Cassidy either. It's just a name given to this character. But this goes all empty and dependent. You know, the AI said, I'm not allowed to put up pictures of actual people. like this cowboy character, based on clear. And so I was thinking, like, this is how actors work and how they get in trouble, isn't it? You know, sometimes we've got, so an actor takes on a role. You go, is he the person? You go, no, he's just taking on the role. Does he look like the person? Oh, heck yeah, in the script he has to, doesn't he? He's got to really look like the character, otherwise we wouldn't believe him. And we know that sometimes actors have difficulty coming out of that role. But they identify so strongly with the role that problems arise. And we are the same, right? We have an identity and we give ourselves the roles and then we identify with them. And we think, this is what I am. Yeah. These guys think, no, that's what you made up. You just made it all up. And now you're clinging to it as if it's real, and now you've got a big problem. Now we have to untangle it all. You go along and see the psychologist, like, and we have to undo it.
Well, interesting about the system is its complete rejection of inherent existence and its complete acceptance of dependent origination. Depend upon cause and conditions, depend upon past, depend upon basis and label. And these two truths, ultimate truth and conventional truth, are like just looking at one thing from different perspectives. It's the same phenomenon. Look at anything that's real, it's empty and dependent. We are empty and dependent as we look at one another. So all categories are mind-made conventions without any fixed boundaries. Now we put the boundaries on that way. We make them up. How we study and practice? So you do it through understanding what emptiness is, and you understand it through dependent arising. That's the easiest, simplest way to get at it. If it's dependent, it must be empty. Has to be empty of any inherent existence. Empty of any. So the simple way it says, if it is a dependent arising, it is not, it does not exist independently. It's independent and dependent are opposites. It can only be one of them, can't be both. If it's one, it's not the other. That's a real simple way of thinking, I think. And the easiest way to practice this is just to remember that dependency. It's all dependent. Many times it doesn't look like that to you. Like I'm looking at that, if you look at the glass here in the windows, does the idea of a person blowing glass arise to your mind? No, it doesn't, does it? Yeah, it is. It is dependent upon all these different things. Does it look like, depends upon sand? You go, no. No sand doesn't arise. It just looks like a window to me. And there you have independent, right? Right there. Not dependent. Does it look like it's just out there without depending upon my senses at all? Yeah. So dependent arises as there, but it's not appearing. Independence appears. Not dependent appears. Now again, this gives you a great deal of emotional resilience when you realize all things arise dependently. When you're suffering, you've got to look at what part am I playing in this? Because it's dependent upon me. A natural sense of altruism arises when you realize that the vast majority of beings all over the world are apprehending everything as if they have some sort of independent, true existence. And they're responding to those appearances as if it were true, and it's not true. That's a terrible thing. I mean, you look at every politician, Trump and all those guys you see carrying on, they're all behaving as if what they're thinking is true. And we're a big mess. Doesn't have to be though. If you knew that, well, of course, this idea of patience should rise to us. A lot of flexibility in what you choose to do here. And the other thing is it has to sharpen your presence. When you realize it, of course, all things are empty of any intrinsic existence. Consequences follow every action. There are consequences for what we think, say, and do. But so you become much more careful. And you see, when you work out what works, kindness works, compassion works, non-harmfulness, that's what works. You try and work like that because that's what works. Hate, anger, belligerence, all the negative stuff we call negative emotions, it just hurts yourself or hurts someone else. And none of us want to be hurt. Okay, so this is our last meditation. Please get comfortable in your seat. Let your shoulders relax, your back straight, and if you like, close your eyes. And sit into your comfortable position. Let your body rest naturally. And make the mind of enlightenment your motivation. If you wish to realize the profound wisdom that benefits all beings who are suffering from the misconceptions they have about reality. And with your eyes closed, say to yourself, I have my eyes closed. And try to find the sense of the I that has its eyes closed. And you find that sense of self or I that possesses the eyes. Now I close. But being unable to find that I does not mean the self does not exist. Does not mean that. It means the self or I is a mere name. And that's why I can't be found possessing eyes, possessing thoughts, possessing feelings. So all of our suffering stems from this grasping at or believing in a self that is more than a name. When you find yourself grasping at the self, your own sense of being, which is more than a name, you'll know you're on the wrong track. See if you can just release the belief, the grasping, the attachment to your own name. It's just a name. Breathing in, exhale, let your eyes bug open. So what this means here is that, as you're, I'm sure none of you think that you're nothing, but all of you will think you're something. If that something is more than the name I, look out. The rest of the crap's going to roll right down onto you. That's what happens, right? We've gone a little bit too far. It'll take time, of course, to change our behavior. It does. It takes a lot of time, actually. But the time we can really speed up the process is to keep looking for the I that you think truly exists and seeing it doesn't exist in that way. You keep doing that because you're more and more conscious that I can relax. I can relax, I can hear what they're saying. It doesn't mean I don't exist. Of course I exist, I can hear them. But if I think I'm more than just a name, you're wrong. If you can do this, believe me, you'll be much more relaxed about things, that's for sure. Stuff can happen, you must get, it's fine, it's okay, it's okay. You've got a lot of room to move in here. Because so the two graspings, the two false beliefs will be in yourself and other things. If either of those things appear to be more than names, it'll get a little difficult. Okay, that'll do. And there are many, many other benefits here, of course, but I'll just leave it out there. So the next course that we're doing is on death and rebirth. And Geshe Sherpa is coming, so he's going to give teachings on these two truths. So I thought if anyone who came to it, I'll at least prepare you for it. It'll probably take a very different tack than I did. I'll try to give you an overview of it. Just prepare you if you want to go to it. So let's take the effort, the energy that you're putting to just sitting here, listening, comprehending, thinking, and so forth, and aim it towards the goals that we're seeking. A complete freedom from suffering and its causes, and the complete flourishing of all your good qualities. So due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel, Bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as seeking beings remain, may I too remain to the spell of sailors of the world. And we have two sets of prayers, one for His Holiness and one for Rupesha. So for His Holiness, the wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world. To the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I behave. May all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And for Rupesha's return. In holding and spreading the Rudy's precious and complete teachings through exploration and practice, you wore the armor of patience that has never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you, I make this success. Okay. Thank you, everybody. I hope you've got something you can take away with you that's useful. And thank you, those online.